Our featured guest today, Doug Lewin, is a nationally recognized energy expert, particularly in the electric grid, renewable energy, energy efficiency, demand response, and utility regulation. Doug is president of Stoic Energy, LLC, an energy advisory consulting firm focused on markets, technology, and policy, which he founded in 2018. Previously, he had worked in government and regulatory affairs for Clear Result, an energy efficient program implementer. And prior to Clear Result, he was the founding executive director of the South Central Partnership for Energy Efficiency as a Resource, or SPEER. He's a contributor of articles on Texas energy to many publications, has been featured in TV and radio segments throughout Texas and nationally, including Renewable Energy World, The New York Times, The Austin American Statesman, Dallas Morning News, The Houston Chronicle, Texas Monthly, and more. His newsletter, the Texas Energy and Power newsletter, and his podcast, the Texas Power Podcast at Renewable Energy World, keep us informed on the Texas energy market. And I'll let Doug tell you what he does with the Aggies, because it's a pretty good story, too. But Doug earned his bachelor's and master's degrees from the University of Texas at Austin and is a proud husband and father of four children. Doug, welcome to Hill Country Institute Live.
Larry, thanks so much for having me. Appreciate it.
Yep, it's a delight to have you here. I follow your work. I've first met you at the Texas A&M event that I mentioned. Why don't you tell, what do you do with Texas A&M? I think that's a good story.
Well, I helped them pull together an event. It's called the Texas Energy Summit. It's really meant to explore the overlap and connection between air quality and energy systems. There's a whole lot of great conferences that focus on environment or air quality. There's a whole lot of great conferences that focus on energy. There are very few that look at how those two influence each other and how they overlap. And that's really what we try to do there. It's we also have a good time. It's a lot of fun, great people, great discussions. And it's a lot of fun pulling it together.
Yeah, and I have benefited greatly from it. You've had legislators, you've had energy experts from a lot of different fields. So it's a terrific event for people that want to know more. Well, Doug, we have a variety of people who listen to our program, and a lot of people think about vocation and what they want to do with their life. So what led you to a career in policy and a career in energy and working well with energy resources?
Yeah, like so many, Larry, it's a kind of a long and winding road. I actually started out in what seems like a past life at this point, but I was a teacher for about 6 years. And I kind of got burnt out on teaching, and I always loved policy and politics, and did something that was popular at that time. It was called the What Color Is My Parachute? Like, read through that book and talked, yes, to a bunch of people, right? Like, the, I don't know if you remember that. I don't know that anybody reads that anymore, but it was super helpful to me, right? Like, what do you really love? And I, like I said, I really love policy. So I went and got an internship. I was probably the oldest intern in the Capitol. It was like in my late 20s. And I just got bit by the bug. I just absolutely loved it. I loved being there. My timing was incredibly good. It was 2005. I was a teacher. I went to work for a member who was on the education committee. It was Renee Oliveira, for anybody like longtime legislative observers or that sort of thing. But he was on the education committee. That was just after the Supreme Court said that our education system was unconstitutional. So there was just a lot of discussions around education going on. There ended up being two special sessions that summer. I wasn't teaching over the summer, so he hired me to stay on over the summer. And I ended up getting hired after that. I worked on in both the House and the Senate. And over the course of my career at the Capitol, I started working for members that just cared a lot about environment and energy and, you know, wanted to do that kind of work. And once I started diving into that, I really just got bit by that bug as well. And I've just been in energy policy ever since. That time when I was at the Capitol, 2005 to 2009, was a really sort of fascinating time for energy policy in Texas. For those that were around, they'll remember, you know, TXU had announced the huge, you know, North Texas company had announced that they were going to build, was it 11 coal plants? Robert Redford made a documentary about this. It's like, you know, it's the story's been told, but there was a huge fight over that. It was also a time when in 2005, in a very bipartisan way, the legislature expanded the renewable portfolio standard. Energy efficiency standards were expanding. You had a Republican and a Democratic candidate for president that both believe climate change is happening and were running on platforms to do something about it. John McCain and Barack Obama, of course. So it was just, it was a fascinating time to be in it. And I just absolutely fell in love with it and been doing it ever since.
Yeah. So there's a, so if someone who's young wants to follow that path, how would you suggest they get started?
I mean, there's so many ways. I think there's so many great NGOs doing work on energy, on air quality, on climate, on all sorts of things adjacent to those things. The interesting thing about this issue area too, as you know, Larry, it touches so many other areas, right? I mean, public health. I mean, I could go down the list. There's very few areas of life or human endeavor that energy systems and environmental concerns don't touch. So there's lots of different entry points to this. You know, my own path going through the legislature, you know, I highly recommend it. I know that sounds crazy, especially, you know, when you see all the headlines coming out of the Capitol and all the crazy stuff going on there right now. But it is a tremendous experience to be inside that building and actually see how laws and statute that you know, literally, you know, govern many aspects of our lives are actually made. You know, similarly for folks that maybe aren't in Austin or don't want to come to Austin, you know, working at a county commissioner's court or working at a city council or mayor's office or something like that are great entry points as well. So NGOs, local governments, companies, right? I mean, there's more and more business activity around clean energy. So I highly encourage folks to look there. You know, there's just so many different entry points to this, but I, you know, like anything else, you kind of learn by doing, just get started and see where it takes you. I find that most people I talk to in life, Larry, I don't know if you find this too, like wherever you are, it wasn't like your plan to be in that spot. Like life is going to take you in different areas and you got to be flexible and kind of go with the flow. But, anywhere you can get started, it'll take you in exciting directions within the space.
Yeah, so that makes a lot of sense. Well, one more question about what you're doing. You have your podcast and your newsletter, and why don't you just tell people how to find those and give them a sense of what they're about?
Yeah, I appreciate that very much, Larry. Thank you. I am trying to build an audience on Substack, and it's been really cool. Actually, I've really enjoyed being on that platform. As you know, I've been active on Twitter. I'll talk about that for a second. It's at Doug Lewin Energy. Folks can find me there. Twitter's been great for, you know, there's a great, you know, if you look at the hashtag energy Twitter, you can find all kinds of good things. I've met a lot of people from around the country and around the world that I've been able to keep in touch with that I've met there. Twitter, I think, though, is very limiting in a lot of ways, right? Limiting literally by the character count, but limiting in a lot of other ways, which we can talk about if you're interested. But I started on Substack because it's just, you know, Twitter threads are great, particularly, you know, if you're tweeting a live hearing or something, but it's not the best medium for really organizing thoughts. Maybe I'm a little old school there, but I like writing an essay and getting the thoughts all together and really plotting it out and editing it, re-editing it and all that kind of stuff. And so I've been posting on there since December or January. I think the first one I wrote was on energy efficiency. It did quite well, got a lot of views, a lot of likes, and I was like, oh, this might work. And so I've been writing on there ever since. DougLewin.substack.com. It is, as you mentioned at the top, called the Texas Energy and Power Newsletter. So that's been a lot of fun. And then late last year, maybe middle of last year, something like that, a friend and colleague at Renewable Energy World reached out and was like, you know, we want to do a podcast focused on Texas. Would you be willing to work with us on that? And so I think we're at like 9 episodes. The last ones, I mentioned TXU building all those coal plants a long time ago, long before the CEO that I just interviewed, he has no interest in building coal plants now. Jim Burke, the CEO of Vistra, was our last guest. We'll have one coming out, I think, this week with the CEO of CPS Energy, the largest combined municipal and gas utility in America, electric utility in America. So I've been able to get great guests. Really appreciate every guest that's been on. It's been a ton of fun. That's called the Texas Power Podcast, and they can find that anywhere they get their podcasts or by going to Renewable Energy World.
Right. Yeah, I know Barry Smitherman is a guest that we've had in common talking about the potential for geothermal, which is a clean energy, steady, reliable. It's got a lot of things going for it. Just a few kinks to get out before we get there, right?
Yeah, and I think we're getting there fast. And the interview with Barry Smitherman was great. I enjoyed doing that. There was also one with, and you might be interested in getting him on your show too, Larry. Tim Latimer with a company called Fervo Energy. He's in Houston. They're through like a Series B round. They've got some demonstration geothermal projects going out west, but they do have Texas on the roadmap. They're going to be working in Texas at some point. Like you said, there's a few things to work out, but I'm very, very bullish on geothermal power.
Yeah, I like what I read or maybe heard this from you, that somebody knew Tim when he was out on the West Coast and, sandals and jeans, kind of figuring things out. And then he came back to Texas where things actually get done. And now
That's right.
he's trying to use all the technology we have for putting holes in the ground. So
Yeah,
I
he was born and raised near like Waco, right? It was like somewhere east of Waco. He's a Texan, but yes, he went out to Stanford and went to school there and met some of the folks he started the company with, and now is back here. And he says, like so many folks you talk to in Houston, like he wanted to be in Texas. Like this is where it's happening on energy. And there's certainly some negative things going on, and we'll talk about that as we go through this podcast, but there's a lot more positive than negative. And I hope people, I know there's a lot of people down about some of the things that are going on and the trajectory of things, but there is a lot to be hopeful and excited about in this state.
Yeah, well, let's move to Texas then. Let's literally and figuratively. Let's talk about history. How come Texas has its own grid? We got three grids in the country. Texas has its own grid. What's up with that?
Yeah, I mean, talk about a long and winding road. It really just comes down to Texans just not wanting to be subject to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission in the wake of the Federal Power Act being formed. And before it was FERC, as we know it now, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, it was the Federal Power Commission established under the Power Act in the 1930s. And Texans back then decided they did not want to be subject to that federal jurisdiction, so they kept everything in state. There is a story that, to be perfectly honest, I did not understand until I listened to the exceptional podcast called The Disconnect by Mose Bushell and the team at KUT. They did a great podcast on this. I'd highly recommend to your listeners, I can send you the link so you can put it into the show notes, Larry, that goes through this whole study, not study, the whole story, I should say, of when I believe it was AEP actually tried to connect a line across the Oklahoma border. They wanted to be subject to federal jurisdiction because they had part of Texas, part of Oklahoma, part of Arkansas, and it was very difficult for them having that Texas part disconnected. And so there was this big lawsuit. Mose and his team were able to track down the man who was there and sort of like ordered the line to be connected. He was a young man at the time, back in the 60s or 70s, an old man when Mose found him in his like later 80s. But he did talk to them and told the story. And I'm not sure that story had been captured. So Mose did us all a service by that. But ultimately, the courts decided that line wasn't enough. They ordered the line taken down. And so we are still an independent grid in it. And it basically, there's a lot more to be said about it. You could have a whole podcast just on this, as Mose and others have done, but it really just comes down to Texans' resistance to federal regulation and wanting to have that control of the system within the state.
Well, in 2011, we had a major winter storm, and you don't fully get away from FERC or the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission's authority, and they made some recommendations. And then in 2021, we had Winter Storm Uri, and when we have a lot of knowledge about Winter Storm Uri and what happened. The FERC did a report. Joshua Rhodes at the University of Texas did a report. When as we go forward, think about what we should do and what we aren't and are doing. What happened during Uri? I mean, that's probably the first place to really look at.
So, but I'm gonna answer that question in just a second. I do want to back up a step to 2011, and I also just kind of want to make sure we don't leave this point, because you're right. What you said at the beginning of that we don't fully escape for jurisdiction. That is an extremely important point that I think is often lost on the general public and even on policymakers. The only area where we are not subject to FERC jurisdiction is on the marketplace, the commerce aspect of it. Under federal law, FERC has very clear and direct jurisdiction over Texas for reliability should they choose to exercise that power. And then Chairman Glick, after Uri, reiterated this in several news conferences and hearings and kept saying, we can exercise this authority should we choose. So I think that's really important. If you know, listeners are like, hey, we don't want to be subject to federal jurisdiction, we've got to figure out the reliability piece here. Otherwise, we do open ourselves up to that that federal regulation. In 2011, there was what was a pretty significant blackout at that time, right? It was, so to put it in perspective, Uri at the peak moment, we think, because we don't know how much demand was actually there because we weren't able to serve it, so you couldn't measure it. So you're doing estimates. And we know that ERCOT is not very good at estimating load. But based on their estimates, we were 20 gigawatts short. So to put that in perspective for your listeners, Larry, I know you know how much that is, but let's put it in perspective. You know, a city of Austin's about 3.5 gigawatts. San Antonio is about 7. The entire Houston area is 12 to 13. So to be 20 gigawatts short, obviously, is a massive amount. But in 2011, we were about 5 gigawatts short. So that's, you know, an Austin and a half. So that is a lot. That is a major outage. It lasted for 12 or so hours as opposed to several days. So it certainly wasn't as deep as Uri, but to have an Austin and a half of unserved energy for 12 hours is a major, major event. FERC and NERC made a bunch of recommendations, many of which were not implemented. Some were, to be clear. Sometimes hear people say, we didn't do anything. That's not true. We did some things, but we did not implement all or even most of the recommendations that came out at that time. Fast forward to 2021, those chickens came home to roost. And by not, you know, having the action after 2011, we suffered even worse. And we'll talk about the causes in just a second, but I want to make sure that this is crystal clear, because I think this is, again, lost on the general public a lot of the time. We have not implemented all of the recommendations that FERC and NERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, the North American Electric Reliability Corporation, you know, I liken them to like NTSB, the National Transportation Safety Board, after a plane crash, right? Like they come in and they do a report and they say, here's what we got to do to make sure the plane doesn't crash again. That's what NERC and FERC did. They did this postmortem, 310 pages. They looked into every aspect of it. They made 28 recommendations. Many of these recommendations have still not been acted upon. One of those, which we'll talk about over the course of this podcast, is energy efficiency. They said you need to get better control of what's going on the demand side. Well, just this week, Public Utility Commission and ERCOT hold a press conference and say, demand has risen so much, we're not sure we're going to be able to serve it. Have you done anything on energy efficiency? Have you done anything on residential demand response? 27 months after Uri, 18 months after the NERC and FERC report came out, the answer is no, we have not. That's just one thing from the report we haven't implemented. Yeah. All right, so now let me answer your question. Sorry. So what happened during Uri? A lot of things happened at its most basic, and I'll keep this answer short, and then we can dive into it more if you want to. This is not going to be a comprehensive answer because, right, I mean, the report is 310 pages. There's also a UT Energy Institute report that's great on this. But I think at its most basic, what happened was it was a failure of regulation. A failure of regulation to winterize gas supply and power plants. And power plants of all different kinds failed. Gas, coal, nuclear, wind, solar all had problems. Gas supply had major problems, and gas supply was already going downhill before the power ever went out. And then we got into a downward spiral where, because there wasn't gas going to gas plants, some of those gas plants, even if they were weatherized, weren't able to run. Because just like a car, if you don't put gas in it, doesn't matter how well you maintain your car, if you can't put gas in it, it's not going to go very far unless you have an electric vehicle. But so So the gas plants then went out and either they were freezing or didn't have fuel. Well, the gas, you know, drillers and the gathering lines, the compressor stations, all that stuff needs electricity. So then they're without power. Now you have more gas going out, less gas getting to the power plants, and you're in a downward spiral. So that we got into that downward spiral. And by the end of the event, by, you know, February 16, February 17, 80% drop in production of natural gas. The other key part of this is that's the supply picture. We always want to make sure we're having these discussions. We talk about supply and demand. Demand was out of control. ERCOT thinks it was 77 gigawatts. A Texas A&M researcher, Andrew Dessler, did some research and he estimates that we actually probably needed 82 gigawatts. Our peak all time in the summer is 80. So that would make us actually a winter peaking system, but we don't actually know how much. So the lack of weatherization of our homes and buildings also cost us. So the through line there is a lack of weatherization of gas supply, lack of weatherization of power plants, lack of weatherization of homes and buildings. And that led to the catastrophe.
Okay. In 2022, in December, we had another storm. It wasn't as long, it wasn't as cold, there wasn't ice, but we struggled. The renewables, we're going to talk a lot about renewables, but renewables have been getting a negative slant in the legislature and from a lot of Texas politicians. How did wind, solar, and fossil gas electricity fare during the winter storm in 2022?
Yeah, and I went into some detail on this on one of my Substack articles that I think is called What ERCOT Knows and Isn't Telling Us or something like that. And what happened on those days, you're talking about just before Christmas, folks who are your listeners in Texas, well, this was around the country, right? Unless you were on the West Coast, I think pretty much everywhere else was bitter cold during this period. Temperatures dropped severely. In fact, I mean, got close to Uri levels, of course, did not stay that cold for as long, right? We didn't have 100 plus hours of below freezing, but it was quite cold. And what you had with that system was what we see in a lot of winter systems is December 22nd, it got really cold. And on the edge of that front, and everybody's experienced this, right? If you went out and tried to cover up your plants, like I tried to do, cover up pipes and all that stuff, if you waited a little too long, you felt that strong wind coming through with the front. Well, yes. All day on December 22nd, the wind was blowing like gangbusters. And it's a good thing because that is when the power demand was the highest. And we had a lot of wind and the wind stayed actually quite strong through that night. It died down the next morning and during the day. That was a very sunny day. December 23rd. So it was still bitterly cold. There's no snow and ice. The solar resource was phenomenal that day and really carried us through that day. The night of December 22nd, when we went to bed that night, around 9 p.m., if you went to bed early that night, at about 9 p.m., we had 6,000 megawatts worth of thermal plants. That's gas, coal, and nuclear. None of the nuclear plants were off. So it's just gas and coal. We're offline. When you woke up that morning by 9 a.m. on December 23rd, there were 14,000 megawatts of gas and coal plants offline. No snow and ice. So what does this tell us? We have not sufficiently winterized our gas plants and our coal plants. That they continue to be a problem in cold weather. Now, this is an interesting point. The system worked, right? All of these different resources worked together effectively. And wind carried us through the night of the 22nd, solar carried us through the day of the 23rd. By the time the sun went down on the 23rd, it was not windy, the sun went down. And by that point, many of those gas and coal plants that had been broken and offline were fixed and came back, and those carried us the night of the 23rd. So it sort of speaks to this, like we really need to be careful in these discussions to not let this devolve into a binary good versus bad. I know there's emissions associated with gas and coal. They still, for not coal, I think coal is a different discussion, but gas for at least a period of time is going to have a role in our system. And if you don't believe that, look at the data on the night of December 23rd. But conversely, if you're some kind of anti-renewable person, look at the data, because on the night of December 22nd, we would have been in serious trouble without the wind. And on the in the middle of the day on the 23rd, we would have been in serious trouble without solar, because so many of the gas and coal plants were offline. Last note on December 22nd and 23rd, Larry, gas production was also, I should take that back. I should be careful. I'm often corrected by critics on Twitter, and I try to learn from my critics. It wasn't gas production. Gas output was down 30%. Whether or not it was production or whether or not that was actually happening at the compressor station or the gathering line or the pipeline, many of the problems happen at the pipelines. So that's not production. But the output, what was actually flowing to the city gate, to the power plants, that was down 32%, according to analyst Wood Mackenzie, as reported by Russell Gold in Texas Monthly. So that tells us that we have still not sufficiently weatherized our gas supply. So that's why I keep coming back to that, that weatherization piece.
Sure. So just to summary statement for anybody that's listening, whether you're pro or con renewables, during that winter storm, the state probably at least would have had rolling blackouts if it hadn't been for the combination of wind and solar on the 22nd and 23rd. Is that right?
I mean, it, you know, counterfactuals are hard. We would have been very close to that edge. And I think there's a very high likelihood that we would have had outages. It's pretty impossible to say definitively that's the case, but high likelihood, yes, there would have been rolling outages without wind and solar on those days.
So, Doug, I've just been kind of laying the stage, but this is the key question that I'll keep coming back to in various ways during our conversation. How are we doing on making electricity affordable and reliable in Texas? Because that's the big picture. It needs to be affordable because over 40% of the people in Texas struggle with their energy bills, and it has to be reliable. We're all concerned about that.
Yeah. You know, these are, they're two different questions. They're obviously very, there's points of intersection and you know, between them. But I would say on affordability, let's start there. It's not good. I mean, it's better now than it was last year, right? But we have a system that is highly dependent upon gas. We're highly reliant on gas. For all the discussion about renewables and how great they are and how much they've risen, we still have a gas-dependent system. And one of the problems with having a gas-dependent system is it's a very volatile fuel as far as the price goes, right? It's a very volatile commodity. And last year we saw prices in the $7, $8, $9 range throughout much of the year. Right now, gas is sitting at $2. So power prices are going down, and that's a good thing for consumers. The problem is if we continue to have a system that is very reliant on gas, particularly high capacity factor gas, right? We should be precise here. Again, like I said earlier, I think gas is going to have a role in the system, but I think it's going to be at lower and lower capacity factors. And that's good for consumers. That is good for consumers of all kinds. It's great for manufacturers who can get lower power prices here than they can get other places. It's also great for residential consumers. The more renewables we have with a zero marginal fuel cost, the better off that is for consumers. Josh Rhodes, a researcher at University of Texas, did a study, and since 2010, we've got somewhere right around $30 billion in savings from renewables over the last decade or so. In 2022, with those high gas prices, just through the first 8 months of the year, that was over $7 billion. So just from renewables. And again, that's because gas and coal prices were very inflated, very high last year. The other thing we really need to do for consumers is help them with energy efficiency. There's just so much. There are programs that we have, most of it's federal funding that pass through state agencies. We don't, as a state, I don't think, put any to this anymore. But there are payments to help people when they're in trouble, things like LIHEAP, I forget what the acronym is, but it's federal money that flows through Housing Community Affairs, Texas Department of Housing Community Affairs, and helps people when they're struggling with their bills. What energy efficiency does is lower that bill permanently. Right. It also increases the safety, comfort of the folks inside the home, but it reduces their bills permanently. We are extremely low on energy efficiency in Texas. We were the first state to establish an energy efficiency goal. Since the time we put that into place in 1999, 26 other states have followed us, but we have let our energy efficiency programs degrade to the point where we are 27th out of 27 states, dead last of all the states with a goal on the size of our goal. So in happy news, Larry, the Senate did pass a bill that will increase our energy efficiency goals significantly. Very hopeful the House will pick that up and act on it and push that through, and the governor would sign it. And that would, that bill would put us basically in the middle of the pack of the states that have goals. And I'm okay with that because we're starting from a really low base. Like, I'd love for us to be number one, but crawl, walk, run. Let's just start ramping those things up. And that would make a significant difference for consumers and also for reliability. So let's talk about the reliability question. How are we doing there? I actually think that our biggest problems are in the winter. I think that summer is a problem for a little while, but as we get more solar and as we get more storage, I think we're going to be able to solve those summer problems. And we can talk about those more if you like. There is a, you know, what's often called the ramping problem, that as the sun goes down and demand is high, you have these problems. I think that those can be solved by a mix of things like storage, geothermal, which can actually act as a form of storage. We could talk about that if you're interested. And then residential demand response. Like, we need that as well. Folks pre-cooling their homes, having, you know, anybody with a pool, don't run that pool pump at 7 or 8 at 9 at night. Think of all the pools around the Dallas-Fort Worth area, all the pools around the Houston area. All those pool pumps can be running any time of day. That's crazy. There's really simple fixes to reduce demand at the times of highest peak, but this has not been a focus for the state. And that is something that FERC and NERC told us we need to do. We need to do energy efficiency. We need to do demand response. We haven't done those things. So that to me, the biggest missing piece to get to a truly reliable system comes down to that one word, which is weatherization. And it's weatherization of gas supply, power plants, and of homes and buildings.
Sure. Yeah, there's a lot of potential there for us. And some of these things are common sense. I know I was testifying in one of the Senate committees, and Senator Nichols has a manufacturing operation. And he just simply decided they weren't going to turn all their machines on at once, so they wouldn't have a surge. And by spreading out the machines coming online, that both reduced their bill, which was an affordability issue, and it also helped with the strain on the grid. So it seems like if we could just share best practices, that alone might make a difference. Yeah.
And so one of the beautiful things, Larry, that we're seeing also is just the technology that is helping folks with that. Like, he probably had to do that manually, or have his facility engineer, facility manager do that manually. We now have software programs, and they're, you know, it's, you know, the computing power and the advances in software and in automated intelligence and all that is going to make that stuff so much easier that it's a push of a button to optimize energy use. And those technologies are coming, and I think they're going to be widely available, not just to factory owners, but to homeowners, to help them control their energy costs inside their homes as well.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Demand response. That's a good word. Check it out on your own, for your own home. Doug, just to go a little bit different direction, in your newsletter this week, you commented that the PUCT, the Public Utility Commission of Texas, and ERCOT had a press conference. You know, that kind of sounds like the setup for a joke, you know, a priest, a rabbi, and a pastor walk into a press conference. But this is really a very serious matter. The grid is more reliable than ever, said ERCOT CEO Pablo Vegas. Vegas also said there is a higher risk of emergency operations this summer compared to last. So more reliable than ever, except for last summer, you wrote. And then PUC Texas Chair Peter Lake said, the risk of brief periods of load shed has increased. So, Doug, tell me, are we more reliable or do we have more risk?
Yeah, I don't think they did themselves any favors with that press conference, right? It's like, what is your message? Is your message that everything is good and we shouldn't worry, or that we should all be freaking out and buying generators? And they're trying to send both messages. And I don't understand it. It's not helpful. What is my assessment of things this summer? I do think that there is some risk. I don't think the risk is for the reasons that they say it is. They're trying to make this all about renewables, that renewables have screwed everything up and we can't rely on these things, but we have to rely on them. And I think instead, I think what the actual problem is we have not had enough focus on bringing flexible resources into our system. So we were just talking about demand response. If we had even a little bit of residential demand response, that would help mightily this summer, because basically what you're talking about with that is the ability to push a button. If you had a bunch of pool pumps on that, if you had a bunch of hot water heaters on that, for folks that are willing to do this, and I want to be clear about this because the language is a little tough, it's a demand response. It sounds like there's a demand being made. When we talk about demand, we're talking about the peak demand on the system, right? These kinds of programs and offerings are totally voluntary. And if you don't want to participate, if your neighbor does, that's good for you because it lowers the overall system costs and helps the grid stay reliable. So I want to be clear, like even 10% of the population signing up for something like this would have a massive impact and in a major way lower the risk coming into the summer for blackouts. And we've known this. They had a workshop in the summer of 2021 when the chairman was there, and he listened all day long to folks from companies that told him, we can implement this stuff right now. Get us started. Give us something and we'll go out there and get this stuff going. Google Nest testified that there are 1 million smart thermostats in the state of Texas. This was 2 years ago, so it's a higher number now. 1 million smart thermostats, and they said 90% of them don't participate in any demand response program whatsoever. So this is no additional cost. The hardware is already there. All you need is a price signal and an offering, and customers can sign up and they can help keep the grid reliable this summer. The other thing is we're getting a lot of storage, and ERCOT is heavily, heavily discounting storage in their long range, what's called the capacity demand reserve report. They're counting storage as zero. And the seasonal assessment, they're counting it at like 10 or 15% of its capacity. And what they're saying is that, well, we're looking at how it's been used historically, and historically it's been used during the day a lot. So we don't think it'll be available at 8 at night when the sun goes down. Well, historically, there was hardly any storage. Historically, there was hardly any solar. Nobody's going to deploy their battery storage at 1 o'clock when there's 15 gigawatts of solar on the system. What's happening here, Larry, and this is very unfortunate, is they're spinning. They have a narrative that they're trying to sell the public, and they're, because they really want a capacity market. They want to change the way our electric market is set up. They want to be able to raise costs to send more money to gas and coal generators. And so this is the story they think they have to tell. They think they have to scare people. They're trying to use fear to get what they want. But they put themselves in a bind because the chairman's been there for 2 years. So it's like, you're saying everything's messed up. Well, why didn't you fix it? Why haven't you made any progress? So they're trying to have it both ways and say it's more reliable than ever, and it's not reliable at all. And it's leaving, one of the reporters, Phil Jankowski, said during the press conference, he's like, you literally just said it's the most reliable ever and we might have blackouts. I'm confused. What's going on? And so the message is muddled and messy and mixed. And anyway, so I would say this, Larry, I don't think people should be overly worried coming into the summer. I think with the storage we got coming in, I think we're going to be okay. The big wild card, and again, this was not mentioned in a 32-minute press conference, they never said the words climate change, right? So that's the other piece of this, is that we are seeing hotter and hotter summers. And that's kind of the wild card here. We saw that last July, right? An intense heat wave and droughts and all that. And if that's the real wild card, that stuff happens, all bets are off and things could get pretty dicey.
Sure. Well, we have increased heat. We have drought. Thermal plants use water. That's another piece of the equation. And right. Population growth, more and more people, hotter. Those two things are both going to magnify our issues. Chairman Lake, during that time and in other situations, had said, we don't have an operational issue. We have a supply and demand issue. And there's one other person to bring into this discussion. That's the Independent Market Monitor, Terry Bivens. And now Terry Bivens made a statement that was a little bit different the other day in testimony. And I was there testifying too, because I'm a strong proponent of renewable energy, and I'm not pleased with the way the renewables are being treated in this legislative session. But what's an independent market monitor? Do we have a supply and demand issue, or do we have an operational issue? How do you see that?
So first of all, I want to thank you, Larry, for showing up and being there and testifying like you do. I know it's not easy because they keep you waiting forever. They don't set that up to be easy on citizens that want to come and have their voice heard. So you're doing a public service and the Lord's work, and appreciate you. So thank you. I think that Kerry Bivens has this right. And I think that Pablo Vegas and Peter Lake, the ERCOT CEO and the chairman of the PUC, have it wrong. I think, and it's interesting that Kerry is an independent market monitor. It's unfortunate that at this point, that ERCOT really isn't an independent entity anymore. Senate Bill 2 from last session, which was a bill, by the way, that was completely totally subbed out on the third to the last day of the session. So when they changed that ERCOT board, there were no hearings, there was no testimony. They completely changed the structure of the governance at ERCOT without any public input, which they are legally allowed to do, but that doesn't make it right. I think it was tremendously wrong that they did that. And unfortunately, that means that ERCOT is now, this is a political body. The board is politically appointed, and the ERCOT CEO now is much more of a political animal. The independent market monitor is not. She's independent. She's calling balls and strikes. She's calling it. She's been quite brave and courageous through all this. The pressure's got to be significant on her, but she's calling it like she sees it. And what is happening is we really do have these operational flexibility problems. This is not, we have enough generation in the state to meet our demand. And if we did something to reduce demand, that would be even more true. We'd have even more of a buffer. ERCOT's own numbers show that we have a 30% surplus of supply compared to demand. This is in that capacity demand reserve report. But there are times where things will be tight and dicey. And you look at last year in July, you look at last year in May, you can look at these few days out of the year where things are real dicey, and that's where you need battery storage. That's where you need flexible geothermal that can have a variable output. That's where you need energy efficiency and demand response. And that's where, frankly, you probably need some reciprocating engines, some small sort of modular gas units that can turn on very quickly and only operate for a few hours, have very low capacity factors. Make a lot of money to operate for a very short period of time, so their emissions are quite low. That kind of operational flexibility is really what the system is begging for. This is not so much a problem of supply and demand. You sent me this morning that article from S&P, and thanks for sending it. You know, the amount of storage that's in the queue, we've got all kinds of resources that are falling over themselves to get into the ERCOT market. Our supply and demand going forward looks quite good. And again, if you don't believe me, read ERCOT's own report that says the same thing. It's not a problem of supply and demand. It truly is operational flexibility. And I think that they are running around saying that it's supply and demand is a real problem, because that means they're not addressing the actual problem. And that increases the risk on the public.
Yeah. Well, other states are just doing everything they can, you know, to bring in renewable energy. And we're ahead. We lead in renewable energy production. The massive amount of energy storage that's being built is underway and in the queue. I mean, it's astounding. I mean, isn't it like 30 megawatts now with a addition, you know, maybe twice that much more behind it?
Gigawatts. Of solar. Are you talking about storage?
Yeah, storage.
Yeah. I think that's what that S&P article said, right? Is there something like 30 in the queue? Now, to be clear, the queue is, you know, developers that are considering a project and depending, there's different sort of phases in the interconnection queue. Yes. So if you're in the first phase, it's pretty speculative. It doesn't cost, I don't think, any money. Maybe it's a couple $100 or something to like fill out a form. So to be clear, not all of that is necessarily going to get built, but there's quite a bit also in the more advanced stages when they actually have an interconnection agreement signed. They've actually put financial assurance down. There's, I think, a good 10,000 megawatts or so. So we already have about 3,000. So, you know, I think by July 2024, ERCOT expects, based on things that have signed agreements, there will be over 10,000 megawatts of storage by next summer. So that's, you know, not quite a Houston worth of storage. I mean, it's, yeah, you're absolutely right. It's astounding. And just about any other state would just, you know, do anything to have this amount of low cost solar, you know, very predictable producing power at the hottest times during the summer and storage there for when the sun goes down. Like we have been handed a bounty in Texas. And for some reason, our leaders are constantly bemoaning it like it's a bad thing. I don't understand it.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. And, you know, in being around the legislature, you hear the term the Texas economic miracle. And one of the things that the new Texas, the forward looking 21st century Texas needs is clean energy so that companies like Google and Apple and others will GM will keep locating their facilities here and bringing those jobs. How important is helping those companies meet their clean energy goals for the growth of Texas?
I think it's incredibly important. And I think, you know, Texas is a place where, you know, companies and people have made things, right? We're a state with a lot of manufacturing and a lot of pride in that manufacturing. Well, manufacturing depends on low cost power. It is one of their major inputs to their bottom line. And when you look at a system with high renewables, you're looking at a system with much lower costs. Is it challenging to try to integrate renewables, which are, of course, variable in their output? Yes, it's challenging. Is challenging the same as impossible? No, of course not, right? It is a challenge that we as Texans should embrace and should meet head on. And you know, look, I mean, if you imagine a governor, this one or a future one, hopefully this one, being able to tell a manufacturer considering locating in the state of Texas, you might be able to have zero cost power for 80% of the year, 80% of the hours in the year. I mean, you know, and you can, and wow. Again, this is demand response as well, right? If you have, depending on what you make, there's certain manufacturers that they've just got to have power 24/7, right? If you're making fertilizer, you know, something like that, like there's certain processes that just have to keep running. There's other kinds of manufacturing that can start up and shut down. And if you can do that, you might just have not quite free, nothing's free, but like as close to free as you could possibly imagine power. What does that mean for the future of our state and our economy? Right? I mean, it has major implications, and there are very few states or areas in the world that could offer that to manufacturers. But with our bounty and abundance of wind and solar resource, we can do that here. You look at hydrogen, you look at direct air capture, you look at electric vehicles, you look at these loads that are large, flexible loads. If I'm capturing, if I'm pulling carbon out of the air, I don't care when I'm doing it. Right. So I can shut that thing down when things are tight on the grid and let those electrons flow into DFW or Houston or whatever, and then turn it back on once, you know, the sun comes back up or the wind's blowing. You can do that with hydrogen. You can do that with all sorts of things. As a matter of fact, So the implications are huge, but none of that works if policymakers. It could work with policymakers not supporting it. It's a lot harder, right? Yeah. I mean, it'd be a lot easier to be able to sell that vision to companies that, hey, you're coming to a place where you got low cost power, clean power, come to our state. You know, that's a very compelling thing for companies and very important. And by the way, Larry, and I know you know this, but I just want to make sure that the audience knows, it is not only Apple and Google. They're a part of it, but I mean, it's Walmart, it's Frito-Lay, it's HEB. They're all purchasing renewables, and some of them are doing it because of sustainability or carbon, you know, emission goals. They all are doing it also, or only because of the low prices, depending on who they are, right? At this point, we have crossed that threshold where renewables are the lowest cost source.
One other thing I want to ask you about, I'm afraid we're getting short on time, but it's difficult to build transmission lines in Texas. And when I talked with Daniel Cohen, one of the things he said, you know, generally somewhere in Texas, the wind's blowing or the sun's shining because we're a big state, but we're not connecting the dots. How can we connect the dots, and how important is it to build more transmission lines?
It's critically important, and the transmission bills, at least for now, seem to be kind of stalled out. Hopefully, before the end of the session, those move again. But yeah, without being able to connect, load and demand to those power sources, it's really gonna cause costs to go up. It's gonna cause reliability to go down. And emissions to go up. It's bad on all those counts to not have more transmission. I'll tell you, one of the most fascinating things happening right now, Larry, is that the big oil and gas companies in the Permian want to be connected to the grid. They want to be connected to the grid for several reasons, but one of them is what we just talked about. They need low-cost power too. If you're out there with a drilling rig in the Permian and you gotta power your operations with diesel, guess what? Diesel's very expensive. Natural gas is cheap right now, but it's variable, right? They want to be connected to the grid. They want to power their operations with renewables. Some would see that as sort of an irony. I don't. I just think renewables are just, anybody who can get their hands on renewables wants them, seemingly, except for some Texas policymakers. But everybody else in the world, including oil and gas companies, want renewables to power their operations. But right now, that oil and gas load out in the Permian is 3 or 4 gigawatts. They're looking at that going up to like 10 or 12 in the next 10 years. They need more transmission to be able to get those renewables. So this is not, anybody who thinks that building transmission is just about some kind of subsidy for renewables, wrong, wrong, wrong. It's good for the entire state, including our oil and gas producers.
Yes, and it's good for our landowners and particularly West Texas, but all over Texas where these solar and wind generators are located. So it's a win-win on multiple ways. Well, Doug, I've got so many more things I'd love to talk to you about. I'm going to extend you an invitation now. Hope we can get together soon. Maybe when the legislature's over, we can have a session and just talk about what's happened. But I thank you so much for your time. I thank you for your diligence and keeping up with these things and keeping us informed. So you continue to do your good work. Thank you.
Appreciate you, Larry. Thank you.